Way out west in Perth Hills, Western Australia, there's a myth. A myth that's been passed down from studio engineer to studio engineer. An urban legend about a mad scientist known only as Dr. Alien Smith. Half man, half alien, half Australian. Usually found in his lab, Dr. Alien Smith, known sometimes to the locals as Al Smith, has created quite a stir with his inventive yet sublimely usable studio tools. Rumor has it that the doctor's creations have been seen in many high-profile sessions and studios, including the famous Abbey Road studio. Please join us as we uncover the truth behind the doctor and hear directly from the mad genius himself how he got started making his mad creations.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
No worries.
Yeah. How did you get started with your music journey?
Well, I guess I approached music being a fan first and foremost. I never learnt an instrument as a kid, or no one in my family was particularly musical, but listening to music was the thing that sort of in my teen years really connected with me. And I just fell in love with lots of sort of bands and just wanted to be involved in music in general. And I guess because I didn't have that performance background or any sort of playing, I mean, I could have probably picked up a guitar or a bass back then. I probably should have.
Yeah.
but I just looked to work out other ways to be involved.
Hey, you dove right in, and just right on your own volition.
So I went to straight out of high school. I did a year of audio school, and the local branch of an international school that was around at the time. And that basically kicked me off. Once I was there, I was just blown away by every aspect of recording, especially. Yeah. That's where things opened up for me after that. So,
and was that your first time recording music? Did you kind of go to school to like learn it, or did you have any kind of experiments before that that you had maybe started on? Maybe like you said earlier that you had gotten started kind of in the early 90s a little bit. With your career, did you happen to stumble upon the old cassette trick where you were just overdubbing music onto cassettes until it was just basically white noise?
Nope.
Proper as anybody can tackle it, right?
Yeah. So I did all those things, but I didn't actually do them until I was 17. I was going to the audio school, and it wasn't enough to sort of be mucking around with the gear, because it was only a part-time course I went to, so it was only like three nights a week or two nights a week. So it wasn't enough for me to be dabbling that limited amount of time. So that's when I started. I had a two cassette boombox and that sort of thing. And so at home during that time, I was really getting into it, and ended up getting into, buying my first four track, one of those Tascam cassette machines.
Porta Studios.
So really the technical side of things, I didn't really get into it all until I hit the school. So
it's kind of nice. You went in unencumbered by, years of bad practices. You got to go in with the passion for music and kind of learn it to do it, I hesitate to say correct way, but a little bit more proper without being too married to bad habits,
I guess there was some guidance there on exploring stuff straight away. But it's one of those things. I also came into it so raw that I had to learn a lot of basic concepts pretty straight away. But it was a good experience. And from there it was, that was it. I was hooked. I was into it.
Did you have any path into doing any live mixing or anything like that? Or was it just straight into studio? Like that was just kind of the aim?
I did a little bit. I had the worst experiences in live stuff straight away. I guess that almost informed my... So at the school, obviously, little job opportunities would come up, because I was working full-time just in a factory during the day and doing the auto school at night. So part-time job opportunities would come up, and I put my hand up for one, which was doing the live sound at a local theater restaurant. I think that's what they're called. People 60 to, everywhere from 50s to 70s, people would get to this theater restaurant and they'd go and eat their sort of eat their dinner, and then there would be a stage show. And it was a full-on stage show where it was singing, dancing, comedy.
Wow, that sounds great.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah, it was crazy. And they had a little sound booth, obviously. And, this was probably 91, I guess. So I finished audio school in 91. And there were things, it was actually bafflingly technical. So I had to... there would be skits on stage where there'd be sound effects and stuff like that, and I'd have to be queuing up a reel-to-reel tape in order to, because it was
I can imagine.
Even back then, the restaurant was very low budget, so they didn't have the latest sort of gear. So even back then, having a reel-to-reel to queue off sound effects was crazy. They probably could have had them on a CD, but
different times.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah, non-issues today. But it was a terrifying experience because the whole show rested on my cues. And I reckon by the end of the 6 months, I'd aged probably 3 years through that experience because I was doing that show sort of trial by fire.
I feel like, all it takes really is a couple of bad live experiences to scare a good engineer back into the studio, I think.
I reckon,
vice versa. Some people are really just... take to live so well. I feel like people figure out pretty quick which one they tend to prefer.
Yeah, and for me, based on that experience, I just decided that the studio is much safer environment, and I was happy to be in much more control.
Cave,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
But over the years, I would have loved to explore doing proper band stuff. That would have been good. But it's just something that I was more focused on the studio, so I never really. Launched into. I was very happy attending gigs and being in the crowd and sort of enjoying the experience. So
yeah, enjoy live as something you experience rather than trying to wrangle it as your profession.
Yeah, but it gave me the ultimate respect for live sound engineers.
Definitely, I feel the same way.
It's definitely to be sort of have to make quick decisions and really sort of deal with issues instantaneously. Definitely. Like you said before, it takes a certain mentality, I feel like, to deal with that well. So
yeah, very much so. I think live versus studio, it's interesting because so many of the concepts are like similar, but obviously like the hard fundamentals are the same, but there's a ton of discrepancy for how things are used. Like in the studio, compression is almost like it's used for flavor, it's used for controlling dynamics, it's used for so many things. Whereas live, I feel like it's a lot more utilitarian. Like people aren't thinking about like, I'll just throw a LA-2A on the master and that'll gel the live show together. It's a different concept.
That's right. Well, every night is sort of different as well because you're in different venues. You may be in a position where you can carry around, the same gear every night, but every room's so different and every stage and every monitoring setup is so different. So
yeah,
you're really dealing with so many different factors every night.
Very on the fly.
Really, yeah, exactly. And because of the fact I hadn't had very much experience in that world, I guess most of the products I've put out have been slanted towards studio work.
Totally. Yeah.
But it has been really cool to find out that some of the stuff's getting used live as well.
I can imagine a lot of your lineup is awesome. Extremely useful live. I've definitely pitched the dirt mic to a couple of my friends who, they're using similar microphones, but they're processing it already to get dirt, in heavier bands and punk bands and noise bands. And I'm like, just skip the middleman, As far as getting into kind of studio work, did you then kind of do the traditional path of applying at like a respected studio in your area and kind of working your way up, or what did that journey look like for you?
Well, yeah,
what's your unique path?
I live in Perth, so it's a city on the west coast of Australia, and it's the only city on this side. Australia's a large country with a small population. And all of the music industry is focused on the East Coast. So Sydney traditionally has been the industry town, Melbourne and Brisbane to a lesser degree. But the classic thing when I was coming up was bands would get to a certain level in Perth and then head over east. I imagine the same sort of thing in the US where bands feel like they got to head to New York or LA or
Yeah.
Or Nashville, you know, the sort of big music cities to sort of
it's
really
spread
crank
out,
up careers and stuff.
There's hubs.
Yeah, there's hubs. So there's 6,000 kilometers separating my city from the music town. So
oh my goodness.
There were, you know, the record labels would have small offices in Perth, but no, staffed by one person. You know, like it was really was they were working more on distributing stuff to stores rather than looking for talent. So
yeah, makes sense.
So all of the studios, this is in the 90s, were pretty much owner operated. No one was employing anybody. You know, at the time I was faced with either trying to move to a bigger city or just sort of going out on my own to a degree. And once I finished at the audio school, the manager of that school took me aside and said, look, you know, if you want to keep recording some bands, you can use these studios after hours and you know, I'll charge you a little bit, but feel free to, you know, to keep working here sort of thing. So for the next year after that school, I would basically, you know, put up a notice in all the record stores and stuff around the city and try and get bands to come and record with me, and it tended to be the sort of metal bands at the time. So essentially I was freelancing out of a studio that had no engineer. It was just me.
Hey, that's how I got started. Like, all right.
same
exact path. My buddy did a similar thing where he's like, oh, you know, use this after hours and I'll charge you so and such amount of money. And there was really no engineer there most of the time. So I would kind of just pay for the studio and then the bands would pay me a bit on top of that. And it's honestly a great starting point, I think, for
a lot of engineers. So much trial and error.
Oh, yeah.
So much trial and error. But at the same time, you're sort of a little freer maybe to make some mistakes. And, you know, I felt like I made plenty of mistakes in those early days, but working with some good bands and got some good results for somebody who was only just starting out. So
Sort
of word of mouth. Yeah, word of mouth grew from there. And after a while, I found out that the school manager was actually pocketing the money he was charging me and not giving it to the school. So he got sacked.
Oh, man.
He got
what a legend.
He got fired. Yeah, I loved the guy. He was an awesome dude, but obviously he was doing something that shouldn't have been going on. So
very,
he got fired.
Very much the case some of the time.
Yeah. So I lost my studio space and then I just started freelancing out of other places. So I never got the chance to work with anybody else. I never got the chance to sort of sit in on other people's sessions. I was really 100% just sort of flying by the seat of my pants. So,
well, all right. Sounds like it translated into a great long career.
Yeah. Well, it's eventually after, you know, 10 years of freelancing and stuff like that, I was in a position where I could get my first premises, and it was inside a rehearsal room sort of complex. So the owner of the rehearsal rooms built me a control room that was right up against two rehearsal rooms, and I would just pay a simple, fairly cheap rent for the control room part of the studio. And then when I was recording bands, then I'd hire out the two rehearsal rooms as well. So I had low overheads. And
Very convenient arrangement. Kind of a modular
setup.
Yeah,
but a lot of bands.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, exactly, a modular. Plus the bands coming through the rehearsal rooms week in, week out. You know, I got a chance just to talk to so many bands and got a lot of work out of that. So
yeah, word of mouth is powerful. Yeah. Once one band knows you're doing good work, the word will spread real quick.
Yeah, especially in a small scene. You know, like the great thing about Perth is there's no, well, the good and the bad. The upside to not having music industry here was that bands were fully into creating their own thing. They weren't having to, you know, they weren't pushing themselves in a certain style because that was the latest thing that labels were signing. So I found that the musicians here were amazing, creative, and just doing it for the sake of doing it rather than sort of trying to make a career out of it necessarily. So,
yeah, it's always
small scene.
Yeah,
a lot of great
bands.
Comes
with those pros and cons for sure.
Yeah, exactly. There's always an up and down.
Yeah, I always say that a similar thing about where I live. I live in kind of a more rural place. It's like the good side, there's no industry. The bad side, there's no industry. So depending on how you look at it, you know, you can swing it however, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, live with the pros and cons. So
yeah, you do.
With your audio engineering, how did you kind of become acquainted with building equipment and become interested in kind of fashioning your own line of things?
Yeah.
the current line?
Well, I'd always, because I was doing everything by myself, you know, very DIY. I was leasing premises and stuff like that, but I didn't have a huge budget for gear. You know, I would buy something if I wasn't using it all the time in my general sort of day-to-day work, after a couple of months, and I would, you know, sell it straight on and get something else. So it was sort of gear was coming in and coming out, and I wasn't able to buy, like, I've never owned any sort of real, I've never paid more than probably $2,000 for a mic.
Yeah.
Probably even $1,000 really. But so I was very focused on using and getting gear that didn't cost a lot of money, but that just really worked. And in those sort of situations, you're forced to really know the gear you have and what its limitations are and what it can do. So I felt like I was pretty good at getting the most out of inexpensive gear. But because of that, what appealed to me was situations where you might buy something that wasn't very expensive, but there was a modification you could make to it that would then sort of open the device up. So whether it was a rack unit that just simply needed some valves to be changed, or you know, maybe a mic that, you know, like the classic sort of Octava mics where,
oh yeah,
the guts of the mics were pretty good, but the bodies were a little, it would always resonate and stuff. I guess
I have one right in front of me as we speak that is currently on the slab, hot rotted out with silicon inside of it to dampen the body resonance and a different capsule.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. So because of the fact I couldn't afford, you know, a lot of high-end gear, I was always looking for scenarios where I could pick up something fairly cheap, put a bit of effort into scrubbing it up, and you'd end up with something that was, you know, worth or sounded much more expensive than it really was. So I just started tinkering around with things like that. And I guess that's a pretty common thing for anyone who owns a studio. You know, you're forced to do a massive amount of your own soldering usually if you're going to, you know, run multi-cores through different rooms and stuff like that. And so soldering was always something I had a pretty good skill at. And then I became over time not afraid to open things up and have a look inside.
Especially not that I have an extensive, not, you know, $5,000 pieces of equipment. A lot easier to stomach when it's one or two K. Or less.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, even when your expertise builds, you know, probably not too scary then either, but.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, but I mean, I don't have a massive, I've never studied electronics or anything like that. I don't have a massive knowledge base, but, you know, re-ribboning microphone, you know, there was a time in the 2000s where the Chinese ribbon sort of situation started where, you know, the factories over there were making a lot of ribbon mics.
Yeah.
And you could pick them up real cheap, just unbranded. And essentially the ribbons were always crappy and saggy and they weren't really properly set. But if you changed out the transformer and you could work out how to re-ribbon the mic, then they were great quality ribbons. And I still have a few of those. I've still got a couple even today of those original mics.
I think ribbon mics in particular too also kind of lend themselves to boutique modifications. They're kind of just like most things in the audio world, right? Like endlessly fiddly. You can kind of just fiddle until you get something where you want it. And I think ribbon mics are a really good embodiment of that concept where there is no right or a wrong way, but you know, you develop your preferences and how to execute those over time. It tends to be a little more material and a little less technical in some ways.
Yeah, exactly, because it's a physical thing, like setting that ribbon in between those two magnets.
Right? Yeah, whereas so manufacturing your own small diaphragm condenser capsules is a entirely different.
type of... that's right.
That I think is bordering more in science, you know, and I'm sure...
Yeah, exactly, that's a much bigger scale, like a trickier scale. Yeah, but so I was always mucking around with things like that, I guess, and obviously not a lot of budget to repair things if they break, so always looking... opening things up just to see if there was an easy fix on stuff. So I guess I always had the bug for modifications, always had the ability to do that sort of stuff. But it wasn't until, I guess, a friend of mine who owned a studio in Perth would eventually move to Melbourne, an engineer called Max Ducker. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a studio called Cellar Sessions. I've kept in touch with him over the years after he moved from Perth, and he actually he's a live sound engineer as well. So he developed his own product. It's like a he called it the Can't Stand Your Microphone Mountain. It was like a cab grabber style thing where you would set it up. It was a variation on that sort of theme for putting mics in front of amps quickly and with a small footprint. And I bought a couple of those and just was using them all the time. Just went, wow, what an amazing thing. Like Max saw something in his day-to-day work, especially live, I think, where, you know, to set up a mic quickly on an amp is something that's really great, and to set it up so it's secure and it has a small footprint on stage, really good. And I was just blown away by that. I thought, wow, Max, you legend, you've created something that's out there in the world now that is actually a really helpful, useful piece of gear.
Yeah, how inspiring.
And it was really great. He did an awesome job. I'm looking at a couple I've got set up on an amp right now. And
proudly, yeah.
Yeah, still using them. They're great. So I thought, and that sort of coupled with a situation, this is a fairly long explanation, but this sort of coupled with a situation where I was actually mixing a band from San Francisco. And they had done a session with a recording session in a great studio over there, and they'd sent me over the multi-tracks, and the everything was recorded beautifully. I can't remember the engineer's name.
Maybe it was might have been Sam Pure or something, someone up in
it was a more San Francisco. A guy who I should have fact-checked this before.
It's okay. I threw a little bit of a curveball at you, I think, with the question.
But so the multi-tracks were great, awesome, a mixer's dream. But he included a sub-kick track, and I'd never always loved the idea of a sub-kick, and always mucked around with crappy speakers and never got a great sound. Never had the chance to use the Yamaha version. Mm-hmm. But when I listened to this sub-kick track and the way it blended in with the kit mics, it was just a real revelation. Like, it sounded amazing. It was just the perfect bottom ends, and it just effortlessly slotted into that mix. Now, he had also expertly recorded the drums in such a way that it was a great session overall. But I just remember thinking, wow, I've got to try and sort out a way to get a sub-kick. And looking at sub-kick prices, you know, on the secondhand market, the Yamahas, they go for crazy prices.
Yeah, they're pricey.
Very pricey, and not a lot in Australia either. But I thought, I'm not going to spend, you know, $600 or $700 US to basically get a speaker.
Yeah, get a speaker hooked up in a way that can record to the right impedance, you know?
yeah, that's right. It's so massive as
not
well.
Not to shame, like, Yamaha, thing, yeah.
No. It's a perfect
great
product.
It's an amazing product, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a reason why they're still so popular, even after being discontinued for such a long time. But you know, they're bulky as well, and they come on their own stand. You know, there's a bit of a pain. But I started mucking around with. I thought, right, I'm going to go out and just buy different speakers from different places. And I never used NS10, so I wasn't going to. Didn't have access to, you know, that classic sort of NS10 driver. But and I just started experimenting, and I ended up finding a speaker from sort of like a local warehouse, and it just sounded great. Like, it was perfect. It wasn't the NS10 sound, but it just definitely had something else. It was maybe a little bit punchier, still had the bottom end, but it wasn't as soft sounding.
Especially for the style of stuff that you tended to record, that's probably perfect.
That's right,
the
heavier sort of thing. Yeah, it didn't ring out for quite as long. And that was an advantage with sort of faster music, I guess, as well. So, so I started mucking around that, and I thought, well, look, this speaker is it. You know, I'm using it all the time. You know, and then from that process, I thought, I'm going to take this as a challenge and see if I can get something up to speed that's sort of worthy of selling. You know, it was something that someone would look at and go, you know what, I'd love to buy that. So, inspired by Max's Can't Stand Your Mic Mount. And I thought, well, drummers like wooden shells, so I'm going to put it in a bamboo enclosure. That was my first product, the Sub-Kick 01. So, and I started selling that, and that was basically the way I got into the putting out products myself.
I see. So, did you have a good sourcing on that speaker driver then, if you were putting kind of...
I did. I had...
Wow. Wonderful.
Yeah, so I could get them in fairly easily, but I guess in the end, like, I don't sell it now, but the only reason I don't is because yeah, the factory that was making those speakers discontinued it. So,
oh, how unfortunate.
Yeah, so I think I sold like there's sort of probably 350 of them out there in the world, and but yeah, I tried after that, and I'm still sort of looking, sort of more passively now. But if I find another speaker, then I'll probably start it up again. But yeah, I just couldn't find anything else that had that same sound, and I wasn't gonna just put out something. You know, I could have replaced it speaker with any number of things.
You're not trying to downgrade. You have a high QC, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Plus, it did have something. You know, that speaker did have something. You know, and I was using it all the time, and other people were enjoying it as well. So, it was pointless to sort of replicate it unless,
you could either do it, the same or better. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Or it had its own unique sound that was, I felt like it was good, because I feel, I've been a sound engineer for a long time and worked with hundreds of bands over the years. I feel like I'm able to tell if something sounds good. I feel like that's sort of something I can do.
Keen instincts.
Yeah. So I can. So that's what I tend to look for if I'm going to put something out. It has to be something that I can use and have been using, and you know, I feel like is really contributing to some sort of sound capture way, I guess.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's so cool to hear kind of the lineage, because I had never heard of the Subkick. I think I heard about your company after that, and it's cool to hear that maybe some of the ideas from that made their way into your Alienate Encapsulate microphones, and kind of a similar kind of ballparked idea, but on a smaller scale, to maybe be less of a Subkick mic and maybe more like general purpose, general use microphones.
Yeah, that's right, because the Subkick is very niche. Like, you use it on a kick drum. Sometimes you might think about
bass cabinet, amp. Or,
but it's definitely a very niche product. So yeah. So that's right.
How did you go into that? Into kind of translating from maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Was the first product you made after the Subkick the Alienate, or did you kind of like this journey of coming up with different ideas and figuring out how to execute them?
Well, after the Subkick was sort of out and about. The next thing I did was the Dirt Mic, actually. So,
oh, awesome. Yeah. With the Super Lux kind of modification with your own custom circuit.
Yeah. That's right. So it's a harmonica mic, which is, using the Super Lux harmonica mic, which is a surprisingly good harmonica microphone, but it's I guess it's a copy of the classic Shure.
Probably Green Bullet style, at least the housing looks like it for sure.
Yeah, the housing's the same and the insides are fairly similar but a bit different. So again, this is more born from recording. I guess I worked with a lot of heavy bands over the years. I guess the majority, 80% of the sort of bands I've worked with have been punk, hardcore, or metal, or some sort of dissonant sort of heavy guitar band, I guess. And getting a good gainy distorted vocal was always a challenge, because it was something that was obviously requested a lot, to get a heavy or aggressive singer's voice to really sort of spit and snarl. Good to have a little bit of gain on it, you know, just sort of breaking up and that sort of thing. And I always struggled to get that sound.
Surprisingly tough to get that sound. I think that maybe it's kind of an underrated effect. You know, a lot of bands come through and ask about like stroke style vocals, even like surf rock, you know, and it's like actually quite tough to get that in the box unless you want to spend a lot of time carving things around, or you can plug in a solution that works quickly. You know, it's kind of one or the other with distortions, I find.
Yeah, it is. And I was always, there was another studio in Perth at the time that, the guy used to get amazing vocal sounds, like distorted vocal sounds.
Yeah.
And I managed to catch up with him and I said, how the hell are you doing this? Like, I really, you know, if you're willing to share your secret. But and he explained to me this long, complicated chain of reamping into guitar amps and pedals and crazy setups. And I was thinking, and I just scratching my head going, man, I don't have enough time in a recording session to... because I'm working with a lot of bands who don't have a huge budget, so it's all about
making sure that this robbing yourself of time to, you know, you don't want to be getting the setup time. You just want to get into making a good sounding recording. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, you want to keep the session going smooth. You don't want things to get hindered by technical things like that. You don't want to spend 3 hours setting up a distortion for the vocals and then use the effect three times in one song out of 10. So it was something that always bugged me. So I guess after having the sub kick and being pretty happy with that, I thought, well, the next thing I'd really like to solve for myself is getting a really good distorted vocal sound. So, I just started researching things and, wanted to, you know, the first prototype was, I can't even remember what mic capsule I was using, but, it was a dynamic mic inside this massive silver torch body with some batteries powering this
sounds like a fuzz circuit. Monster.
Yeah. And it was too big and too bulky and
kind of less of a microphone, more of a process.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in the end, was able to refine it down, learn about the Superlux mic. There's plenty of space inside it. Put together a circuit in the circuit board and managed to, with some advice from some electronic technical friends of mine, managed to get it phantom powered so I didn't have to use batteries and stuff. And started using it in some recordings, and I was working with some heavier bands and people were enjoying using it. So I thought, right, I think I've come up with something good. And I really enjoyed the sound. It's not super flexible in terms of there's no tone controls and things like that. It's just basically a gain and that's it. But the general sound of it was plug and play good. You know, it had a bit of an industrial edge to it. It broke up really well. Extreme settings, the amount of compression and stuff that was coming through was absolutely crazy. So in the end, most of the time I personally use it as a drum room mic almost.
Oh, probably amazing for that. Yeah. Saves you five steps and what you'd usually do on a drum room anyway.
Well, that's right. And you get that instant effect. And plus with singers, you know, I mean, it's very different to do a vocal take and then put an effect on afterwards. If you've got the effect happening straight away, and I mean, computer system, the latency issues and computer systems and that sort of stuff are getting to the point now where,
you know,
I guess UAD.
Almost UAD a non-issue at this point with latency if you're not doing like, you know, mastering while you're going almost. If you're doing anything reasonable on tracks, you know.
So you can set up effects for people to use, you know, as they're tracking live now. It was more of an issue, I guess, for me over the years, not being able to do that. But having that instant, even myself, like if you're singing with the distortion, then you sing with the distortion. You know what
Very
I mean? You know,
so, yeah.
you can feel how
becomes
to push
a part
that
of the
effect.
Performance, yeah.
It really does. And it's like any sort of effect or style of sound. And I imagine this, you know, we talked about the Strokes before.
Totally.
I imagine that part of the vocal performance in those sort of classic albums was basically they had that sound straight away.
Digging into the growl, I think it was
I
hear it was like a small PV combo or something, you know, something probably SM58 plugged directly in. I can imagine something like of that nature.
And he would have been listening to that sound as he was doing the takes, you know. It does make a big difference. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of if you know in advance that you're going to have a certain feel or vibe or something to a song, then especially, I guess, an aggressive song where the singer wants to have some distortion, then I feel like really they need to be doing the take with that distortion.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Yeah, I think that's kind of the argument for that workflow in general too, is like the performance is so guided by the sonics, you know, it is almost like a mix as you go or produce as you go kind of thing. Even if you go in with a really good idea, you know, there's nothing wrong with recording things like, say, like DI or anything like that. You know, there's no right or wrong way to attach yourself to methods. It's all just tools to play with. But there is something, I think, a little bit more intuitive to miking the sound of a cabinet as opposed to figuring it out later when it comes to the performance element, especially, you know.
Definitely.
The flexibility of sound is kind of a negotiating factor there, for sure.
Yeah,
you know, like if someone really doesn't know what tone they want, then maybe, you know, but how can a metal guitarist play, you know, with an amp sim turned on? Sure. But, you know, recording metal guitar with no distortion is kind of I think, a very strange sounding endeavor, you know. And I think especially back in the day, you know, when that wasn't an option, it made a whole lot more sense. And yeah, like there's still like such a great vibe in the studio from using something more intuitive, something more plug and play. We have option paralysis now, you know. We have the opposite problem where, you know, you can go out and buy about as high level professional equipment as you can get for what, $300-$400 for most things, for most tasks, and an unlimited software array. But sometimes you just need to cut the noise and focus on something that is tailored to the performance and brings the best out of that, and then commit to that early to save yourself the headaches later and just get the best out of the bands.
Yeah, exactly. And it pays to have solutions or options that are easily accessible as well. Like, especially, I mean, sure, you hear plenty of stories of, you know, massive bands in the 70s or 80s recording one song at a time and totally changing drum kit setups between every song, and, you know, recordings taking 3 to 6 months. But nobody's really got that sort of time in the real world to be mucking around with that. So you need simple, creative. For me, it was always good to have a few simple, creative things lying around the studio, something that you knew gave a different vibe that instantaneously you could grab and maybe spark something in the studio without, you know, mucking around for hours at a time and just watching the clock drain away, you know, for the day. I mean, the first, I guess, I was very early adopter of the Copperphone, you know, the Placid Audio. I had one of those that went not too long after when they first came out. And just the look of the thing. And,
oh, they're gorgeous.
I mean, the sound is very one.
That's,
you know,
one of those,
one
it's a carbon mic, right? Carbon element mic, yeah. They do look stunning.
They look amazing. And just having that lying around the studio, I mean, it does one thing good. It's not very flexible, and so I don't own it now. But, you know, it was great having that around because you could sort of plug that in and people would just, singers especially, would look at it and go, wow, this is amazing. You know, listen to how it sounds through it, that real lo-fi sound, and just get inspired by that.
Totally.
So I guess that's why something like the Dirt Mic, I guess I really wanted to get that going because love distorted vocals.
Yeah.
you can't have it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Having a tool like that is great. I love that your tools come from such a place of not necessity, but just passion, right? Like your recording career has totally informed your preference in developing gear. You can tell just from the conversation that there's so much that you've developed just because you're like, I think that would be cool. Or you know, coming from that almost, I don't want to say DIY, but like that space of, I got a band with a budget of X amount, I have, you know, X dollars worth of equipment, and just doing the best that you can, and then having the creativity to create something that's tailored to your workflow and preferences is such a, and then sharing that with other people, how cool is that? What an awesome idea.
Yeah, well, I've got my own experience in the studio. And that's where basically everything is born from, I guess, is like you say, just something, there's a gap in the market, or, you know, I want to make something easier so the session flows better and doesn't get bogged down in technical stuff because, you know, you're trying to be creative and bands are trying to be creative, and the studio is a freaky environment sometimes for people, especially young bands.
The nicer the studio, the more scared people get,
you know, well, exactly. Exactly. You walk into a shiny, bright thing that's got racks full of amazing knobs and dials, and you just go, "Whoa, this is really intimidating."
It's enamoring, but it's really intimidating. Yeah, exactly.
So I guess.
Sweet. Yeah, I think as far as kind of some of your other tools, you know, you have the wormhole. Am I getting this right? This is all off memory. I don't have a sheet in front of me, but the worm mic.
Yeah. Right? Well. Yep, the wormhole is more not necessarily a needs-based thing, but just mucking around with a certain technique. So
such a cool idea. I took some inspiration from that, and I have a spiral staircase at my own studio. And for those are out there listening that don't know about the wormhole, it's a long tube with an electret condenser on one end of it. So you use it as a boundary mic that picks up the low end, you know, of the vibrations that it is detecting of what it's touching, you know, surface wise, and maybe a little bit from the air. And I have a big spiral staircase at my studio, nothing, you know, crazy fancy, but it's got a long tube. And so I've kind of mic'd up, it's open-ended on both ends. So now I have, going between two stories. So I'm kind of doing the, when the levee breaks John Bonham thing, where I have a mic almost being used as like a boundary mic on one end, and then, you know, yeah, feed right. the sound to another. So thanks for that idea. It's working great.
Yeah, that is awesome to have something like that.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was just mucking around with, like, I love the concept of the garden hose mic, you know, the Sylvia Massey.
Yeah. What a genius. Concept. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, amazing. And just the creativity on wrapping a garden hose all the way around your drum kit and getting that sort of weird, phasey sort of reverb sound.
Yeah, and it is kind of useful, too, as, like, a adjacent to a room mic, too, right? It's like, you know, just getting that heavy, like, low-end resonance can really liven up a drum set. Make it not sound so thin.
It's something that's not, you can't get it from any other way. You know, it's just such a very unique sound. So I love mucking around with those sorts of things. And I thought, well, how can I can't sell, you know, I mean, you can just go down the hardware store and buy a massive thing of hose and wrap it around. So I started mucking around with the concept and trying to work out if there was a way, or just to try and discover what I could get out of the concept with a shorter hose, because, you know, obviously.
Yeah,
there's no point trying to sell people a 25 meter hose. Gonna cost Dr. hundreds Ian Smith of
gardening accessories. new exactly. business endeavor. Yeah,
that's a pointless thing. But so I was just mucking around with shorter hoses, and then stumbled across. So the shorter hose for the wormhole acts a little bit as a contact mic. You have to be very careful with it, actually. Having it rub up against cymbal stands and stuff like that can actually give you a fairly ugly sort of sound. But using the shorter length of hose and having the electric condenser, so the hose is sort of airtight on one end, and I don't even really know the physical concepts. It was almost an accidentally stumbling on it, but it turns it into, like I say, almost like a boundary mic that just picks up low frequencies, essentially. And because it's picking them up from a bit further away from the kit, usually as well, not like a close mic style thing. Blending the wormhole into your overall drum kit sound, it almost acts like a sub kick for the whole drum kit rather than just the kick drum. So it'll, if you lay it on the floor in front of a kit, it'll pick up all the low end from the kick and the toms.
Mm-hmm.
And again, listening to that mic by itself is pretty bad. Like it's just sounds
it's for flavor.
Yeah, you're that's right.
You don't fill a dish with salt, you know. A little bit goes a long way, yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds sort of like if you're in a rehearsal room complex and the band next to you is playing, you know,
it's the
slow doom metal or something like that, and you're just hearing that through the walls.
Have you seen those internet jokes, those internet memes about, like, oh, this song playing from a Toys R Us bathroom next door at like 3 a.m. or something? Yeah. Kind of that kind of washed out sound. Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting sound. Yeah, like. And it's cool to like introduce a little bit of that low end alongside like a little bit of phase too, you know. It just adds that like a little bit of extra little flavor, you know, to mix into taste.
Yeah, so I mean you can put like a stereo EQ across the drum bus and lift up the whole low end, but something a little bit different that, about, you know? Yeah.
And that only works if you have, you know, a $8,000 equalizer, you know. It's very, very expensive, very difficult, you know, to do a low end boost. No, yeah. I'm kidding. I joke.
So that was a fun thing to muck around with, and I sort of stumbled across this sort of low end factor. So in the end, it's the wormhole's different than wrapping a garden hose around a kit, but
it definitely
does its own thing. Yeah, yeah. And I guess the other thing with the Alien 8 mic is probably, I'd say, the most successful thing in terms of other people's, you know, really, really digging it. Again, I guess similar to the Subkick, I mean, I was very keen to try out the Beyer M380.
Yeah.
You know, the classic mic that Steve Albini's always talking about.
Yeah, and, gigantic low end, yeah.
Yeah, and try and buy one of those on the secondhand market. Yeah. Man, that's worse than three times worse than the Subkick.
That's a serious investment. And it's almost like a, once you get into mics of that price, it's like a statement piece too, alongside being, you know, I think the 380 is a very useful mic, but, you know, it's pricey.
Yeah, it is interesting. Pricey.
How did you come across kind of the, I know the concept kind of came from like the Beyer 380, but you kind of took it a step further, right? Because I don't think that one has two headphone drivers. Yeah,
no, it doesn't. Well, I'd done a single, so again, I've went collecting headphone capsules from various factories and you know, warehouses and stuff like that. And I probably ended up with, I don't know, 20 different ones. And I was just sort of meticulously going through each one, listening to the results. And one in particular stood out to me. I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I was just sort of cobbled together a mount to stick it inside just an empty mic body and put it in the kick drum and went, wow, this is actually pretty good. Sounds really cool. And the next recording I had was actually a thrash band. I'm not going to name them because I'll probably shame them now, but the drummer was awesome dude and an integral part of the band, but he's just had a few. He just had some technical faults with his playing. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, this is a situation where I'm probably going to trigger most of his kick drums anyway, and I may have to edit them in post as it is. So I'm going to chuck this prototype up inside the kick drum for this 3-day recording session. I'm just going to leave it in there and see what happens. And it sounded great. Like, it was just straight away. No EQ.
Fantastic. Just this, yeah.
Well, something weird's going on here because, you know, I feel like this guy's technique's bad. The kit he was using was okay, but the kick sound is actually very usable straight away. So I was like, right, maybe I have stumbled onto something pretty cool. And then back in my own sort of studio at home, just mucking around with a shitty kit I've got here, I just wanted to hear the difference between the front and the back of the mics. So I had two prototypes, single capsule prototypes. And I put them in the kit. One was facing forward, one was facing back. And then I was just listening to the results and the differences. And then I listened to both together. And that was like the moment where I went, oh, damn.
Yeah, the light bulb. Light bulb clicked on. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great hearing sounding mic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's hearing the front of the capsule mixed with the back of the capsule, you know, the back, the one that's facing backwards flipped. So it's in phase. And hearing those together, that blend was just, it had clarity, it had depth, just really. And then I spent the next 3 months going, how the hell am I going to put two capsules?
Yeah, you figured out the idea. Now how are you going to execute it? Yeah,
50 mil capsules. How am I going to put two into one microphone? And so in the end, after mucking around with various sort of body combinations and stuff like that, I found out a great way of doing it. And then that was put in a switch. So, you know, you can select between just the front-facing capsule or just the rear-facing capsule or both together, which is, I mean, I use the switch on both.
That's the creator's intention, is the default, the de facto state.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was really
good. I've been really happy with that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thanks for building it. I got mine in a couple months ago, and it's been on every session since. I have quite a few that I like. You know, there's a lot of kick drum mics, and it's interesting. So I do cut a lot of like metal and hardcore and punk at the studio, but my house kit actually doesn't have the cutout. You know, it's full reso head, and so I was really curious how it would perform. You know, I had this full reso head, and the first band that I had in was like kind of a softer jazz act. You know, so I'm like, oh, how's this gonna work? And it was divine, just perfect articulation. Really healthy, strong low end. You know, it's like my favorite kick drum mic I've used. You know,
yeah. So well, it's funny there. Because and this is where I get a lot of joy out of this sort of stuff. Like, I have never used an outside kick mic pretty much in any of my recordings. I've tried over the years. I didn't have access to a U47 or a U47 clone, so I never knew that sort of classic sound. But I tried hundreds of different mics out there and was never satisfied with any of them. Now, I also regularly recorded mostly heavy, fast bands. So getting that punchy, shorter sort of sound was always the thing I was trying to capture. So I never really needed outside kick mics until I sort of got the Subkick. And that's used for a different way anyway.
Yeah, that's its own category. But
that's right. So I envisioned the Alien 8. 100% to only be inside the kick. And that's the way I'd never even tested it outside the kick. And then I started
how that works,
selling. I started selling them. And people were buying them. And I started seeing pictures of the Alien 8 outside the kick on the back skin. I was going, what the? You know, and I even contacted the first couple of folks. I said, you're supposed to put it inside. And it's like, no, dude. You know, they're just, you should listen to it on the outside. And then from then on, it was like, you know, I reckon probably Well, I mean, it's hard to see pictures of a mic inside a kick anyway, but most of the time I'm seeing the Alienate outside the kick drum now.
You know, it's amazing how that works. It's a phenomenal, you know, kick-in mic, but something I like particularly about the Alienate is that it doesn't lose its punch or impact as a kick-out mic. I think because you tuned it for heavier music, you know, at least for your own preferences, it actually does this thing on the outside where you get like a little bit of that beater kind of sound. Just the contour is really good for getting a good amount of that impact and that like really quick attack, but without like really killing or muddling the low end. You know, there's a lot of other, you know, great kick mics that I think do similar stuff, but it almost has that kind of condenser like appeal, right? That it really reaches high up into the frequency range in a lot of ways to get that articulation and attack. But you still get that massive low end that, you know, usually you'd kind of choose a kick out mic for that reason, and you'd choose a kick in mic for its attack and its clarity. And I find that it does both really well as a kick out mic. I've been pretty much exclusively using it for that role because I don't have the I don't have the cutout in my house kit. So when someone, you know, I have tested as a kick in mic, so I've used it a couple times for that when people bring their own kits with the cutout to the studio. But it's just really, really deep and detailed sound, you know. It's hard to find that kind of punch on a kickout mic, so it's very valuable there.
I know. And that's a great discovery that wasn't discovered by me, you know. Like I had no idea about that. Obviously I've tried it outside now and various times and just gone, wow, yeah, okay, that wasn't the intention, but it's obviously doing its job there too. I guess the size of the mic, it's a little larger, and because it's rectangular and sort of got to be forward facing, it's a little harder to position inside the kick. So I think a lot of people think, you know, they use it outside, tried it outside initially because of that factor, maybe. But it's great. I'm glad it's got two distinctive uses like that, you know.
What a great discovery.
Cool.
So I guess moving in, you know, the Capsulate is a smaller kind of version. It's a single capsule version of the Alienate, correct? It's the same element.
Yep. It's pretty much the same element. It's a different impedance. The only difference is the Alienate has an output transformer. So the two capsules are combined into the transformer. Whereas the Capsulate doesn't. It's just so it's the same style of capsule.
A little leaner and cleaner, little bit less inherent saturation.
That's right, and that's exactly the difference. I found that without the transformer, a little bit more of the attack, a little bit more of that peak sort of comes through the mic. And that has a it's not a major difference, but there's a little more transient there. So I found that mucking around with a single capsule idea without the transformer on toms, I was much happier with because sometimes you really need that initial stick hit
to
come through for faster rolls and stuff. So I found it a benefit. It
can soften things a little bit in a very pleasant way, but it, if you don't want it, you know, it can be a little bit difficult to work through that in post. Yeah. Whereas I find the opposite isn't really as true. Transformerless, I think you get a little more flexibility at the expense of a little bit of that richness from the outset.
Yes, you know? That's right. There's an up and a down for both scenarios. And, the single capsule version as well, which I wanted to explore, was because of the smaller size as well. You can put an Alienate on a rack tom, no problem, or a floor tom or whatever. But
it won't explode.
Having something that's it won't explode. Having something that's a little bit smaller with a smaller sort of footprint.
A little bit more,
especially on toms.
I am curious. Have you ever used the Capsule 8 on snare, or do you know anyone who has? I was really curious about it for that particular use case, even though the tuning doesn't seem like it's entirely oriented for it. I was really curious about its performance there. I wonder if anyone's done like a shootout or a test of that.
Not that I know of. I know a few people have bought them with the idea of really wanting to try them, and I've got some feedback. Some people really dig it. For me, probably it picks up a lot of really low end in the snare, which probably not so useful. So for me, it works okay. It's got an interesting rejection of the hi-hat, so
because figure eight pattern, you could probably just, as long as it's in that null point,
so you can muck around a bit with the null point and you can get a pretty decent sort of rejection. But for me personally, it's not I'm probably not, not going to use Encapsulate. No, I'd probably be, it's not beating out the 57 or the i5 or anything like that. So sounds good. It's got its own sound, but yeah, probably is just tuned to pick up too much low end. So
makes sense. Yeah. More has a specific idea in mind. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you can, yeah, that's right. And it's only going to do what it wants to do.
So I guess maybe just the last question to kind of taper us off. Do you have any other ideas that you've kind of been, you know, messing around with, or things that have been kind of on the bench that you're excited about? Anything that you're at liberty to share? It's okay if you're still, you know, I know that the Capsule 8, I think, just came out not too long ago. So it's okay if it's not a pressing matter. But maybe, you know, if you have some ideas that you've been tinkering around with.
Well, the dirt box, I guess, is the other thing we haven't talked about, and that's essentially the dirt mic circuit in a little enclosure, so you can plug any mic into it and get that same sort of distortion on the mic. So having access to directly affecting sounds at mic level is something that I really
enjoy.
Yeah. So the next thing that will hopefully be come out is a different play on that, I guess. I'm not going to give out too many details, but
Under R&D.
It really is. So it's still under development. It might turn out to be something that doesn't work. So I don't want to sort of hype it up. But we've got a working prototype at the moment, and we're just going through some basic testing and tweaking of that. So, but that's in that sort of world. I've got, I'm looking around the thing now. I can see 3 or 4 things that have been prototyped just sitting there and just will never see the light of day because the concept in my head was good, but in reality, in practice...
Yeah, still fine-tuning.
They're not really giving me... Like, in my head, I had an idea of how I thought they would sound, and they probably don't live up to that. So I'm always mucking around with different things. Always got a couple of half-built bits and pieces lying around that I like to test and sort of elaborate on, but... Yeah, I guess the mic level processing concept is something that will probably be the next thing that becomes an actual Dr. Alien Smith product. So
very exciting.
There we go.
I have one final bonus question, and this is kind of a personal curiosity. What are your favorite pieces of weird gear that you've acquired over the years? Can be anything. You don't have to reveal anything too secretive so the eBay prices don't skyrocket. But, you know, if there's something that you've picked up that you're like, wow, this is weird and I love it. What's a Dr. Alien Smith certified weird piece of gear that you've liked in your studio?
I mean, I used to have this McMartin broadcast limiter as a rack unit. It was the weirdest thing. Like, I guess there's a few of these sort of broadcast limiters out and about that sort of people like to get. They really clamp down on signals, so they sort of really compress hard and they give a sort of quite a unique... I'm trying to think, there was a CBS.
Maybe like a Aphex kind of... I know Aphex makes a bunch of those that are very beloved in the budget category.
Yeah, but it was very unique. It just clamped down on certain things when they hit a certain level and just really distorted in a amazing way. And the reason I don't have it is because it really only did one thing well. But if you were to record hand claps into it and set the threshold right, you'd get the most amazing sounding, slightly distorted, super percussive hand clap sounds that just sounded like instead of 3 people clapping, it turned it into 100 people clapping. It was just amazing. So... But I never held on to it after having it for like about 5 years because how often was I recording hand claps? Not very often. But, and it was pretty much useless for anything else. So, but I've always been curious about those. I still have a search on eBay for them. Every now and again they come up. I think it was something like the LR1004A or something like that, but McMartin broadcast limiter. It was a pretty funky piece of gear. Maybe mine was broken and it didn't work properly yet, but
you never know with some pieces, I don't really know.
Could have been malfunctioning totally, and that was why it was the sound. Yeah. But I guess that one's probably springs to mind the most.
Excellent.
Very unique.
Well, thank you so much for sharing so much of your time and your just, you know, your personality and your journey. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for chatting. It's been fun. So
excellent. Yeah.